Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, Larry Mueller here. Really pleased today to welcome to the studio Jennifer Cheverini of Madison. She is the author of the New York Times bestselling Elm Creek Quilt series of novels, and including the 10th book in her series, which is titled The Quilter's Homecoming. I just, as I mentioned earlier, I finished reading it, enjoyed it very much, and really pleased to have her here to talk about that book and talk about social drama and the art of quilting and all kinds of things. And certainly to encourage your calls as well if you have some questions for her. I know there are some quilters out there who I'm sure are going to want to talk with you, Jennifer, and others as well. So give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Jennifer, welcome back. It's been a couple years.
Yes, it has been. Thanks for having me back.
The last book was The Sugar Camp Quilt, and that book sold pretty well, too.
It did okay, yes.
How's The Quilter's Homecoming doing?
Well, it's doing great. In fact, last week it did reach number 26 on the New York Times bestseller list, so I'm clinging to the bottom of the extended list. But at least, hey, at least I can say I got there.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I tell you what, you have just finished a whole series of appearances, right? You were in Philadelphia,
yeah.
Pittsburgh.
I went through Pennsylvania, and then I did quite a few appearances at bookstores and libraries in Ohio. And this week, I'm in Wisconsin. I'm going to be in Barnes & Noble tonight, and I'll be in Oconomowoc tomorrow at Books & Company. So I get to do Wisconsin for a while, and then after that, I'm heading out to the West Coast.
Oh, so a busy, busy time when you're promoting a book.
Yeah, it really is.
Do you get tired doing it?
Well, I do, but sometimes my mom's a teacher, and she was on spring break last week, so she traveled with me.
Oh, cool.
So that was a lot of fun. I got to meet a lot of readers, and I also got to enjoy some travel time with my mom.
Is she a quilter?
She is now.
So she started after you.
She did. Usually you hear about the tradition being passed down through the generations. Mm-hmm. We're passing the tradition up through the generations.
That's
so
cool.
I taught my mom and she taught my sister. So we're going about in a circle.
How did you get interested in quilting?
Well, I always loved quilts. You know, we didn't have a lot in our home when I was growing up, but I just loved the beauty and the variety of the patterns. And when I got married, like a lot of brides, I wanted a beautiful heirloom wedding quilt to commemorate the occasion. But since I didn't have any quilters, I didn't have a grandmother to make me a quilt, or I couldn't appeal to my mother for one, I thought, if I want one of these beautiful heirlooms, I'm going to have to make it myself. So I bought a little booklet called Teach Yourself How to Quilt, and I followed the step-by-step instructions, and from then, I learned a lot from other quilters, especially from a lot of the online quilting communities out there, and I learned a lot through trial and error.
And but you weren't going to make quilting your professional life, so how did quilting and writing intersect?
When I was writing my first novel, I wanted to write about women and their friendships and also about women valuing the work that they do. And the more I got involved in quilting, the more I saw that this wonderful traditional art that whose traditions are respected and the folklore is passed around the quilting frame, and yet it's very much a thriving contemporary art form as well, with contemporary art quilters as well as traditionalists taking the art of quilting in all kinds of wonderful directions. The more I became aware of everything in that community, the more that I saw that it brought those two themes of friendship and women's work together in a way that no other theme that I had considered earlier really did. So it just became a wonderful place for me to tell this story. And of course, beginning writers are always told, write what you know. Mm-hmm. And since I know about quilters, and I'm a quilter myself, I know about their friendships and about their inside jokes and all of that, mm-hmm. It seemed like a great way for me to share my love of quilting with quilters that I know, and I knew that they would appreciate seeing quilting represented in a way that was respectful and devoid of most of the stereotypes associated with quilting. But I also thought that non-quilters would enjoy some insight into the quilting world, why their quilting friends are so passionate about this art form, and also why quilting should continue to be valued as a legitimate form of art.
And frankly, I'm not a quilter, but I've really enjoyed your books. I mean, there's a great story that, and quilting plays a role, but you don't have to be a quilter to enjoy the story.
Well, I certainly hope not. I've heard from a lot of quilting readers, of course, but also non-quilters. And I know I have to do a fine balance as a writer to include enough of the technical detail so that non-quilters can follow what's going on and get a sense of the pattern, and yet not overburden the story so that it interferes with the plot or the character development, for this, especially for the sake of people who to whom this information is very familiar.
And your the sort of the stars of your book are usually almost always women, or maybe always women, aren't they?
Not always. In my last book, I've heard from men quilters, and they sent me emails and would come to see me at my book signings, and they'd want to know, you know, why don't I have some male quilters in there too? So in my last book, Circle of Quilters, one of the main characters, his name was Russell, and he was a very accomplished contemporary art quilter. So I finally made good on my promise to include some more male quilters.
Well, tell me, tell us a little more about your this book, The Quilter's Homecoming, because it's another sort of history, historical piece.
That's right. Well, I enjoy writing both contemporary and historical novels, and sometimes I'll even include a book in the series that varies between two or more generations, so it's contemporary as well as historical. And I like to do that because when I first got started writing these novels, I had no idea that The Quilter's Apprentice would be the first book in a series. So I didn't plan out a series of, say, 10 books that would go from start to finish, and each one would pick up precisely where the previous one left off. So since I never wanted to be locked into a particular formula fiction series format, I have kept the series fresh and fun and interesting for me as a writer by sometimes focusing on the core group of characters, but other times going back in time to explore one of those main characters' ancestors' lives. And in other cases, I'll take a character who was a secondary figure in an earlier book and let that person take the stage and tell the narrative through that person's eyes. And that's really what I did in The Quilter's Homecoming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Elizabeth appeared in earlier, who is the main character in your book, in this book, appeared in a couple of times in earlier books?
She's appeared in at least two or three that I can think of right away. I really enjoyed writing about Elizabeth. She is Sylvia's favorite cousin, and she has a bit of a playful streak that sometimes skirts the line of what's appropriate behavior. And I really like that about her. One of the things that Elizabeth is best known for is cheating on a Christmas game in the Bergstrom family. And I put this story into the Christmas quilt. The Bergstrom family has a beloved family tradition where they have a red star for the top of the Christmas tree. And every Christmas Eve, one of the grown-ups hides the star somewhere in the house. And all of the children have to run around finding that star. Whoever finds it first not only gets to put the star on top of the tree, but that child also wins a special prize. And Elizabeth put the star, when it was her turn to hide it, she put the star in a place where only Sylvia would think to look, beneath Sylvia's own pillow. And she knew that Sylvia would get tired and discouraged and would run to her room and fling herself onto her bed. And of course, then she would find the star. So I thought anyone who would cheat on a Christmas contest to give the advantage to her favorite cousin, she's someone we need to see more of. So I decided to bring her into her own book and see what happened to her after she left the familiar setting of Elm Creek Manor.
And it's a great story. And, you know, I learned some other things in the book. Was it apricots?
Yes.
It was interesting to me to, and I don't know how much research you had to do for this. As I was reading it, you had a few pages where you're talking about the harvesting of apricots. And I thought, I bet you Jennifer spent a fair amount of time for those few pages.
Well, you do. I think my readers are sticklers for detail. They want me to get those things right. Not only the quilting details and the quilting history, they want the rest of the stuff right too. So when I write a historical novel, it's important to talk to experts, to do a lot of secondary research. And of course, the Wisconsin Historical Society is a wonderful resource right here in Madison that we can all take advantage of. But also, since this book took place in Southern California, and I was basing the valley in the story where Triumph Ranch is located on a real setting, it was very important for me to travel there, not as a former resident returning home myself, but as a researcher and as an author, trying to get those, getting the setting right and getting some of the history right, figuring out how I can take some of the real settings and some of the real characters, and there were some real characters back in Southern California in those days, and pulling them into the story and taking inspiration from them to create this wonderful new environment for Elizabeth's story to play out.
And did you pick a particular area, or is the area you describe sort of a collection of different areas in Southern California?
The valley in the story is based upon the Conejo Valley in Southern California, which is where Thousand Oaks is, which is where I went to high school, which is where my mom and my brother and my sister still live. Although my fictional valley is not meant to be a point-by-point representation of that valley. I drew inspiration from it, and anyone familiar with that, with the Conejo Valley, will definitely recognize real settings, but it's not meant to be a history of Thousand Oaks or a history of Ventura County.
We're talking today with Jennifer Cheverini of Madison, who is author of many books, including the one we're talking about a bit today, The Quilter's Homecoming, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. And I guess Simon & Schuster has published all of your books?
Yes, all of the novels. The pattern books are published by a specialty publisher, but all of my novels have been with Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, wonderful. And here's the number to call if you'd like to join in, 1-800-642-1234, or if you're in Madison at 263-1890, give us a call. And Reed in Clintonville has been waiting a while here. So, Reed, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Well, good morning, Larry and Jennifer. And I guess I just, this program just sort of triggered things in me in the sense that my wife and I, as young at that time, hippies, living in the woods, I manufactured quilt frames, and I sold them all over the U.S. and Mexico and Canada by mail. And my wife and I both quilted. I pieced tops, and Pat used to sew 13 to 16 stitches to the inch.
Wow, that's impressive.
Years ago when we had our first child, she started a quilt. And one thing led to another where, you know, we got busy doing things. She would teach quilting. I was a potter. Somehow that quilt got set aside. And, she said she'd finish it for our second son. Well, that didn't happen either. Here we've just become grandparents. And Pat dug that quilt out, and she just finished it.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yes.
Now, in a way, aren't you glad you saved it?
Yes. Yeah, we are. And it brought back a lot of memories. And she had embroidered the entire alphabet onto blocks, individual blocks, and then pieced those. Our son and daughter-in-law and new baby Sage will be coming from Hong Kong in June. So,
congratulations.
Yeah.
That's so wonderful.
Yeah, and rarely did we tie quilts, only on commission if someone wanted it tied as opposed to hand-quilted. The largest quilt we did was 1,300 pieces, and it was all hand-set and hand-quilted.
Wow.
Yeah. So, hey, thanks for the good memories.
Reed, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Calling. What a wonderful story.
Yeah, I think that's something that we sometimes, when I'm thinking about the contemporary art of quilting, something I like to emphasize, too, is that everyone can quilt. You know, you might not think if you can't sew a dress or if you can't, all you can do is sew on a button. There is a pattern that a simple enough, you can do anything from the most simple pattern to more complex, but it's a very accessible art form. you can jump in. Quilters are always willing to share what they know to help newcomers. They love sharing their passion for quilting. And perhaps that's why quilting especially has become so tied to important family events. In my case, I wanted a bridal quilt. And in this case, and in so many other cases, quilts are made especially to welcome a new family member. And so they're not only important artifacts and they're used to keep the child warm, but it's an important repository of the family identity and the family memory, especially when you're working with scraps. You might see a scrap quilt piece by your grandmother and you might recognize pieces from the dress she wore on her 60th birthday or something from a child's layette. And those kind of scrap quilts really do become a very important heirloom, not so much for the artistry, but because it really is a diary of the family composed in fabric.
Mm. And in your book this time around, one of the characters in the book recognizes a quilt that had to have been made by her mother because of the scraps that she saw.
Yes,
in the,
that's right.
The baby's part of the baby's bonnet and so forth.
That's right. And she's not really sure how her mother made this quilt and how she came by these fabrics. In this story, there are two other characters, Rosa and Isabel, and they have become estranged because of choices that the daughter has made and the older generation's difficulty accepting some of those choices. And I don't want to give away too much.
No.
But because these two have become estranged and the daughter's husband doesn't exactly help with that relationship, the mother wants to reconcile, and she can't approach her daughter for a variety of reasons. And so her apology and her regret, she stitches into this quilt, and she makes it accessible to her daughter later so that she knows her daughter will come by it in time.
Jennifer Cheverini, our guest today, pleased to have her with us as we talk with her about her book, The Quilter's Homecoming, published by Simon & Schuster. If you'd like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller, Jim Packard, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about social drama and the art of quilting today with Jennifer Cheverini. Glad to have you listening in. Certainly, if you want to join with a question about our book or quilting or writing, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in the Madison area at 263-1890. Speaking of the Madison area, I wanted to mention again that Jennifer will be in Madison at 7 p.m. at Barnes & Noble on Mineral Point Road tonight, right, Jennifer?
That's right.
Okay, and then where else are you going to be in Wisconsin? You've got one more trip to in the
state.
That's
right. I'll be at Books & Company in Oconomowoc tomorrow, Wednesday at 7.
And then you're off to the Twin Cities area as well.
Yes, that's right. I'll be up at the Valley Bookseller in Stillwater, and that'll be at 4:30 on Friday.
Jim Packard was wondering whether or not there are insider jokes
for
quilters.
Yeah, we have insider jokes about some of our quirky habits as quilters. We admire tile patterns. Whenever we travel, there's always a unique tile pattern. We might study it and try to think about how we could transform it into a quilt block. We might admire somebody's shirt as they're walking past waiting for the bus and wonder where we can get that exact shade of blue. And then, of course, we always have jokes about UFOs, which are not flying saucers. They are unfinished fabric objects. And some quilters love to start one quilt and complete that quilt before beginning another project. Whereas for others, the idea of starting something new is just so captivating that they might start one project and then before finishing that one, set it aside and begin another one. So they end up having lots of projects in progress and not a whole lot of quilts on the bed. So those are called unfinished fabric objects. Now, some people don't mind admitting to having dozens of unfinished fabric objects, but others are secretly embarrassed by their growing pile of UFOs.
Well, you mentioned patterns, and in your book, on the back side here, you've got a couple of the patterns. And you know what? When I was reading the book, I found myself, I'm going to turn back. So I was going from your description in the story to the back and trying to, you know, sort of follow along and learn a little bit more about these patterns.
Yes, that's right. In the hardcover editions of my novels, ever since The Runaway Quilt, my fourth book, I had been telling my publisher that, you know, my readers really want to see pictures of the quilts as they're reading the books. So since putting a photograph in a novel really is a very expensive option, we've gone with having these beautiful illustrated end papers that Melanie Martyr Parks is the artist who makes them. And she does a beautiful job. Not only does she capture the pattern, but she also captures the spirit of each book that she illustrates. Mm. And so there are four important quilts in the Quilter's Homecoming, and so you get an illustration of each of those in the end papers. So it's fun to look at them and imagine the Bergstrom women or Isabel working on some of those quilts in the story.
Sandra in Concord, we'll go to you now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks. Just a question. It's my understanding that I've been told that slaves in the pre-Civil War South who made a lot of quilts put secret messages in those quilts, messages about escape routes, things like that. Is that true? Do you know anything about that? I'll take the answer off the telephone.
All right, thank you.
Well, that is a very controversial and heated debate between quilters and quilt lovers and historians. Right now, well, there is a very popular story out there that goes into some detail about the quilt code. However, that is become popularized because it is such a wonderful, romantic, evocative story. However, most historians have pointed out, quite rightly, I think, that we don't have documented historical evidence yet to prove that this is true. So I think the debate is still out there. There are some parts of the folklore that are pretty convincingly diffused or rebutted at this point. The idea that the log cabin block with the black center square, that it was used to signal a safe house on the Underground Railroad, as I've mentioned in some of my earlier novels, that idea has pretty much been disproven, I'd say pretty conclusively, because that pattern really didn't become popular until the start of the Civil War, at which point the Underground Railroad had to function in a much different fashion than it did before the start of the war. As far as the quilt code goes, that has been refuted by much more able historians than I. And for people interested in learning more about this, I would strongly encourage you to read Barbara Brackman's new book out from C&T Publishing. The title escapes me right now, but if you Google it, I'm sure you can come up with it, or her own website, you can find it, because she is both a quilter and an historian. So she gets both aspects of this particular historical question right. Some historians who don't know quilting might miss some of those important details, and people who just love quilts don't always have the historian's technical expertise to get that research right. Barbara Brackman is an expert on both sides of that question. She has a new book just out in which she very thoroughly explores this idea. And Barbara Brackman comes down very clearly on the side that the idea of a quilt code that blanketed the entire South, all aspects of the Underground Railroad, probably didn't happen. And she says it's stronger like that. I'm trying to be diplomatic because I know how much quilters love this story. But it seems that it is highly unlikely that quilts were used in a widespread, systematic manner as a quilt code. But I think that when you have a large population that you deny literacy, if you deny an entire disenfranchised population access to reading and writing, then we do have to pay special attention to the oral tradition, because that is where their stories were told. On the other hand, once slaves made it to freedom, they often told slave narratives that were published to help bring attention to the abolitionist movement and to encourage more people to come down on the side against slavery. And none of those accounts ever mentioned
quilts.
Coded messages in quilts. On the other hand, I'm having a number of hands at this point, and this is the debate that's going on. the nature of secret signals is that you wanted to keep them secret. And so the, when you
Why
find...
Why would you say
exactly,
something?
The last thing you want to do when you make it to freedom is spoil it for everyone else who comes after you. So I think Barbara Brackman makes a very convincing case. However, I do want us not to completely discount the oral tradition because it isn't written down. By the nature of the fact that it is the oral tradition, it isn't written down. That is what you have when you're not allowed. When it's against the law for you to learn to read and write, we have to pay extra attention to that. But the debate is still ongoing, and I think it's a healthy, good, strong debate, not only because it brings attention to this interesting period in American history, the idea of the Underground Railroad and the Civil War era and the pre-Civil War era, but it also brings a lot of attention to historical quilts and how important it is to preserve those heirlooms, whether they played an important role in helping someone come to freedom or if they were made, say, as a fundraiser to support abolitionist causes, because those we know
for sure
definitely took place.
I just went online. Is it Facts and Fabrications?
That's the book.
Unraveling the History of Quilts and Slaveries. 8 projects, 20 blocks, first-person accounts.
Yes, so you get some quotes from slave narratives. You get Barbara Brackman's history. And for the quilters out there, you also get some patterns you can make on your own.
All right. Karen in Green Bay, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Speaking of heirloom quilts, that's why I was calling as I was listening to your discussion. I was thinking back to a quilt that my dad has. My dad is 84. He's got a quilt that was made, I believe, by his grandmother. And it is small octagons. The center of the octagon is a piece of fabric, probably no bigger than a nickel.
Oh, my.
And then each octagon is made up of many very small pieces. And the story I was told is that they were so poor that they saved every little scrap of fabric they had, and they would add it to the octagon until it was the right size. Then they'd set that octagon aside, and they'd start another one, and eventually they had enough octagons for a blanket. And that was the blanket that they have, and they still have that. And it's, to me, just an incredible statement of poverty and how you treasure every little scrap you have. And I don't know. I was just, it came to mind as you were talking. And so I think quilting is a big part of our heritage.
I'm going to make a little bet here, Karen. I'm going to bet that quilt never leaves your family.
Oh, no, it never does.
Good.
And my big thing right now is it needs some repair, and I don't know what to do with it or where to go. So if you had any input on that, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. Well, depending upon where you're located, you might have a textile museum. I know we have wonderful experts here in Madison who are archiving the Helen C. White textile collection. And there's also going to be a wonderful museum in, not Deerfield. Oh, someone might know out there and they can call in. But we're in the process of, here in Wisconsin, we're going to have a wonderful quilt museum added to our wonderful historical resources. But I would encourage you to contact a museum who specializes in textiles, or you might want to contact the American Quilter Society to get in touch with quilt appraisers, and they can often direct you to the resources available in your area. The American Quilter Society, or AQS, is available online. They're based in Paducah, but you can contact them through the web or by phone. And you also might want to contact a quilt shop in your area, and they could direct you to appropriate resources, too. One thing I would encourage you to do is not try to mend it yourself without consulting an appraiser or some experts, because sometimes by making your own repairs, it might lessen the value of the quilt. But then again, that might not be what is most important to you. It might be more important to you just to have this family heirloom. But before you take a stitch or before you cut any of those threads, I'd encourage you to have it looked at by an expert, either through the AQS appraisers list or through a quilt shop or a museum.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you very much for calling. And Phyllis in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, Phyllis.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I just wanted to share an idea that I tried for my great-grandchildren. I've been making quilts for the new babies, and I would silk screen the picture of the baby's dad, which is my grandson, and put that in the center of the quilt and then fill in with all kinds of different squares, and that way the parents really appreciated it, and they keep those for an heirloom. So I just thought I would share that with whoever's doing something for their grandchildren. That would be
a good way to do it. Well, thank you, Phyllis. Comment, Jennifer?
Well, that's one of the wonderful new directions that modern technology is letting us use when we're doing our contemporary quilting. There are a variety of specialty fabrics out there perfect for photo transfer. You can put the sheet right in your inkjet printer, go to your digital camera software online. I'm a Mac user. I use iPhoto. Mm-hmm. And you can just print that right out on your paper, let it dry. Sometimes you need to rinse it first and iron it, depending upon the manufacturer. And then you can stitch these beautiful photographs of family members or maybe some old historical photographs from your own family, your great-great-grandmother's wedding portrait, for example, or the picture of a new baby. And you can sew them all into a new heirloom. There's a tradition of album quilts that are autograph album quilts, but now with these other new resources available, we can make photograph album quilts. And anything like that, a gift truly from the heart, very personal for that family member, is always treasured. Or should be.
It should be. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Phyllis.
I always put the date on and everything.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Yes, for future generations. And that's something that a lot of quilters still don't do today and didn't in the past. Sometimes they never imagined that the quilt they were making just to keep everyone warm in the cold Wisconsin winter would become a cherished heirloom 50 years later. So they didn't always sign and date their quilts.
I have some my mother-in-law made when she was a girl, and I cherish those. I really do.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, I'll tell you what, you sound like a wonderful grandmother, too, Phyllis. Thank you very much
I try to be. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. And let's see, let's go to Carol in Black River Falls. Been waiting a while here. Carol, hi.
Hi, Larry.
Thanks for calling.
I'm involved in a quilting operation right now. We're quilting by committee is what the group says. And it's a neighborhood group who've been getting together socially once a month for over 30 years. But this is just a first-time effort we're doing. And the pattern is called Roman coins, I believe. And we've all donated fabric, and we've cut up into scraps and made this pattern. We've all sewn on it independently and together. And it's going to be raffled off by the local hospice organization here. And even the Through and Through Quilting has been donated by one of our local quilters who does that as a business. And her family was involved with hospice personally, and so it was just a great donation quilt. But it's not an heirloom, but it's going to look sharp, and I hope we raise a lot of money for hospice.
Oh.
It's not an heirloom yet. It probably will be.
Well, I don't know. It's going to look sharp. I think it's a kind of a quilt it's got a lot of bright kind of autumn colors in it, and I think men will like it. I think we'll sell tickets to men.
Well, send me a ticket, Carol.
Economy, you know, we're going to sell this quilt. So.
Send me a ticket, and I'll send you some money.
Hey, you're on.
All right, but do that now. I mean it.
Do you have a website available where people can buy their tickets online?
At the local hospice group? I don't know. I don't have an answer to that.
Oh.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you get that information where people can buy tickets to help support your hospice organization, go to my website, email me, and I'll put it on my website, so that people can see about it, and maybe you'll sell some tickets that way.
And what's your website, Jen?
My website is www.elmcreek.net.
Elmcreek.net. And don't forget to send me a ticket, Carol. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Jennifer Cheverini, you know, we haven't talked so much about the Quilter's Homecoming. We talked a little bit about it. It's a wonderful book, and that's what we were ostensibly going to be talking about. And it is about quilting, and it's about the social life of many people, including Elizabeth, who has played a role in some of Jennifer's, at least two of her earlier books, maybe it was three of her earlier books. And so I really want to mention that as well and make sure that you take a look at it the next time you're in a bookstore. Go to your local bookstore and take a look. It's bound to be there. And it's called The Quilter's Homecoming. Tony in Fish Creek, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have an interesting story about quilting, especially for men. When my wife and I first met, this was maybe 14 years ago, she was very interested in quilting, and so I became interested in it. And she said, well, pick out a pattern, and I'll help you get started, which I did. And now whenever we travel, especially by airplane, I'll take that quilt with me, and I'll sit and quilt in the airport, and maybe it's because of the novelty of not seeing many men quilting in public. She'll get up to go to the washroom or to get something to eat, and invariably when she comes back, I'll have a few women who moved closer by and are sitting next to me asking me about my quilt. I'm grateful that she's very secure about that in our relationship, and it doesn't bother her at all. But I guess that's my tip to single men who are interested in meeting women is maybe to sidestep the bars and pick up a quilt and go to an airport.
Well, that's a great story, Jennifer.
I might have to steal that, and you might find yourself in a book someday. So thanks. Thanks for that one.
That's a very, very interesting tip. Single guys, remember that. Jean in Ashland, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. The ancient quilters did not have to worry about this, but have you done any studies on organic fabrics, no toxic elements such as pesticides, herbicides, or toxic dyes, or coatings, or plastics, or...
That sort of thing, yeah.
Well, I haven't done any research on those areas for my books. I have followed various issues that have come up as a quilter, as someone who wants my own quilts to last for a long time. But it's actually not true that quilters of days gone by didn't have to worry about these things, because back then they had trouble finding good, solid, color-fast dyes, and they often had to work with all kinds of different chemicals and mordants and a lot of different things that did deteriorate the fabric over time. So those issues have probably been plaguing quilters ever since the first quilter took up the craft. But there are some ongoing debates about some of the new things that we're bringing into our quilting art, whether it's fusible webbing or temporary adhesive spray to hold those layers together. And fortunately, a lot of quilting publications, such as Quilters Newsletter Magazine, and also organizations that are like AQS, that are in the National Quilters Association, are doing studies to see what the long-term effects of some of these new products might be, because some of them are so new, we honestly don't know how they hold up over time. So some quilters are eager to try anything out. They're early adopters. They're willing to give anything a shot. And other quilters are more reluctant to trust their heirlooms to something until it's been tried and proven over a few generations, especially if they want that quilt to last for generations. So although I haven't done any studies myself, I'm not really in the research field, I have followed it as a quilter concerned about the preservation of my own quilts.
Jennifer, it's always a pleasure to have you come by. Are you working on something else now?
Or I am. I'm always writing. I've had a very busy year since I last was out on the road for a book tour. I have another novel coming out in the fall, The New Year's Quilt. Everyone seemed to like having that extra book in 2005, so I decided to try to do two novels again. And then a year from now, in 2008, I'll have another contemporary full-length novel out, and I'm also going to have a new pattern book out, including the Chimneys and Cornerstones quilt that Elizabeth receives as a wedding present in the Quilter's Homecoming.
Oh.
And this quilt was a collaboration. I made some blocks for it, and then quilters and readers from around the world sent in blocks. A lot of quilters from here in Wisconsin and from as far away as the Netherlands sent in blocks for this quilt. So the patterns for the quilts that Elizabeth encounters in this story will be available next year when that pattern book comes out.
Well, we'll look forward to your next visit then.
Oh, I'd love to come back. I'd love to come back and hear more quilt stories from Wisconsin listeners.
And I tell you what, your website again is?
Elmcreek.net.
Elmcreek.net.
Or just Google me and you'll find me.
And also, you're tonight at Barnes & Noble in Madison on Mineral Point Road at 7 p.m. And then once more in Wisconsin,
I'll be at Books & Company in Oconomowoc tomorrow at 7, at 7.
And then off to the Twin Cities.
That's right. For Friday, I'll be there at 4:30 at Valley Bookseller in Stillwater.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me back.
Jennifer Cheverini of Madison, author of the New York Times bestselling Elm Creek Quilt series of novels, and including the latest, which is on the New York Times bestseller list. It's called The Quilter's Homecoming, and again, it's published by Simon & Schuster. Fun story, and it's always great to talk with her, and we'll look forward to her next visit. Thanks again. Coming up, we're going to take a look at maps and cartography. You know, when we go on the road, my wife, we're sort of the opposite of what the stereotype, let's put it that way. I like to look at the maps. My wife says, no, we don't need the maps. Well, we're not going to talk so much about those kinds of maps, but we'll take a look at the history of maps and the history of cartography with our guest, Matthew Edney, coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.